Welcome to the Startup Addict Podcast. I'm Nick Swinmurn. I've been starting companies for over 20 years now. I've had some big successes, like Zappos.com, and lots of failures. Regardless of the outcome, I'm still convinced there's nothing more addicting than trying to turn ideas into reality.
There he is.
There he is.
Oh my God, I'm the last one?
We started. We're live.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Jim just arrived.
All right, welcome to episode 25, and today we have Ken Martin, and we're going to be talking about lots of things.
So Ken, after Dennis's incredible introduction.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, you make guests feel special, and they're prepared for.
Oh, you know it.
So Ken and I worked together at AutoWeb, one of our first jobs. And then, Ken left, started one agency, and then later started another agency, and then just sold that agency. And now he's sitting in a spa-like room of tranquility.
Yeah, this is my escape from the family, room. Escape
room. So I thought Ken has an interesting story, it's a industry that a lot of people. Potentially a lot of people listening are interested in.
Yeah.
So you, we'll just ask you questions and then you can just ramble off on whatever direction you want.
Yeah. Let me know if the connection is good too.
Is that picture behind you moving?
Yeah, it's a digital frame. A mural.
I was like, what's going on with our TV?
I thought maybe I'd done some drugs before I got here.
All right, so we met at AutoWeb in 1998,
7, 8? I think it's 97.
All right, so what happened What happened before that? From the womb to the web, what happened?
From the womb to the web, okay. So I grew up in sort of the Central Valley area in California near Fresno, and generally like agricultural. And so my dad was really into computers, and so most of my childhood was just looking over his shoulder the whole time. And so, I never got a tan, never learned how to, farm. So as soon as I turned 18, I wanted to find something in computers, and I was really into design at the time as well. And so moved up to the Bay Area to pursue 3D animation.
Literally the day you turned 18 or?
Basically, I school is out in June. I turned 18 in June, and basically planned to move over the summer. So it was pretty immediate. But moved up with a couple high school friends, and we just kind of ripped the Band-Aid off. But the whole kind of 1995, 1996. There was the whole .com stuff was just kind of getting started, and I ran into it from just being with roommates where we were working on 3D animation projects for school, and they were all talking about HTML and geeking out about it, and talking about how they could kind of create stuff, and I wasn't that interested at the time, but at one point I basically decided I was going to leave school, because with that field there was so much happening that you were really only like a couple of days ahead, or the teachers are only a couple of days ahead of you. So if you stayed up and you were really passionate about what you were working on, you were teaching the teachers a lot of the time.
What school was it?
Cogswell, there in Sunnyvale. It was like one of the only colleges at the time in the U.S. that you could get a bachelor's in 3D animation. So a lot of people went off to Pixar, ILM, and so forth.
Nice.
I remember I called my parents and I said, hey, the money that we would be spending on college, if I could spend that on RAM, and a bigger hard drive, I could just sit at home and just do basically everything I need to do to get that done. So they let me do it, dropped out of college. I bought the most expensive computer you could get at the time and just sat in the apartment, and eventually realized I needed money. So I saw the classified or the job posting for AutoWeb, and it was like I forget what it was. It was like, make $25,000 a year. I'm like, that's, I'm going to be rich.
You so made it.
I went down to, there was a bookstore, I think it was in Mountain View, and it was just like a computer bookstore. I bought a book on HTML, like teach yourself HTML in like 3 days or something, read it over the weekend and had that interview at AutoWeb on Monday. Met with them and basically got the job and started working in, you know, kind of web development field from that point on. And then that's where I met Nick.
It's so funny, because I answered an ad, like it was a newspaper ad, like it was in the Mercury News, like
yeah that's where someone
and it's hard to like realize now, but at the time I remember like one of my first days they had like an offsite. I don't remember what it was for, but there was an offsite and they had all the sales guys, which were just young gung-ho guys that were like, we're gonna sell, we're gonna make millions. And I remember one of the guys being like, holy shit, did you hear about Amazon? Like, we're going to be just like Amazon. And I'm like, what the fuck is Amazon?
Yeah.
Like, it just went public. It's like a bookstore. And it's like, what does that have to do with cars? I was like, so confused.
So what was your first impression of Nick when you guys first met?
That's what we all want to know. I was waiting for that question.
This guy's a fucking slacker.
I think you weren't... trying to remember, were you ever in the smaller building, or were you only in the larger building in Sunnyvale?
I think I was in the smaller building for a little bit. I think I started in the smaller building, and then was that the brick building?
It was only like 30 people.
Yeah. I just remember starting. I don't remember how our paths crossed, but I remember walking over to like your guys' side of the room, always and just talking and brainstorming things. I don't remember the transition from that to somehow then always being at your apartment brainstorming ideas and coming up with things.
Yeah, I mean...
were we disgruntled employees?
It was an awesome job. I learned a lot. I think I wanted to climb the corporate ladder quicker than at the time my hair was like bleached white. I looked like I was 13, and I wanted to just basically be in charge. So I think Payam and Frank, weren't necessarily down with that at the moment. I remember wandering over because I think, was it Michelle Hickford? You know, on the marketing side, I would end up going over to your side and I would see Nick stuffing envelopes, and being like, what are you doing over here?
Pretty much what I did. I think I started in customer service and then I transition to marketing coordinator.
Yeah.
But I don't remember what I did. I think I was just asking her like, hey, can I like send me anything you got? Because I want to try to figure out what the hell is going on here.
Right.
It's like that's transferable. But I would just look at these spreadsheets and not really know what was going on. I think I spent most of the time walking over to your guys' section.
It's fun. It's a fun section. I think.
How long were you there for?
Let's see. My wife, Ruth, she started there when we were still dating, and so she was there 2 years. I think I only stayed a year and a half, maybe, because I'd left before they went public.
Yeah.
And then she stayed up until then.
Yeah, I was only there 11 months, because I remember I left a month before I would have vested.
Yeah.
In my rush. So what'd you do? What did you do at AutoWeb? Like, you got this 3D background. You've taught yourself HTML in 48 hours, and then what did your day one look like? And
sure, yeah. So because I had I guess positioned myself as an expert in HTML at that point, they threw me right in. Because basically AutoWeb, you were designing sites for dealerships. AutoWeb was basically a lead gen service leads would come in, you'd do a search for, I'm looking for a Ford and I'm in Canada or wherever, and essentially you would ideally land on one of AutoWeb sites, and then we would refer that over to the dealership and then sort of take a cut. So my job was to interface with the dealerships and figure out how we could take the platform that the developers at AutoWeb built, but then kind of design it to their brand. So if it was a particular large dealership group, a lot of it was pretty much white labeled. So my job was to go in and essentially find out what the dealership wanted that fit their brand, and then work with the internal team to design essentially the website that would be that front door.
How was it dealing with dealerships in the late 90s talking about the internet? They must have been like, what is this? What are you talking about? I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I just can't imagine.
It was like, the sales guys had the easiest job. I mean, it was just free money. They're just calling a dealership and going, hey, you're going to pay us $200 and every time we send you a car lead. And they're like, sign me up. So you had the sales guys, their heads were just getting so big. They literally thought like, you know, I got out of college. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And it turns out I'm a fucking rock star salesman.
There was definitely a difference in the cars being parked in the parking lot by the sales team everyone else. The web team did not have the same cars as the sales team.
Yeah.
So we didn't know how to work those deals. But it was, dealing with the dealerships. I mean, at the end of the day, it was just learning enough about kind of what they wanted, but honestly it was more getting something in front of them. They didn't know what to say, they didn't know how to answer what they were looking for. So I guess where the tact I took is I'm just going to go ahead, go out on a limb, do what I think's right, and then we'll put it in front of them and get them to sign off on it. And that worked really well, just getting them to react to something visually.
So you've got AutoWeb and you've got these dealers, almost like your mini clients. And then all of a sudden, not that long in, you're thinking, I want to leave. I want to start my own agency. Did you pitch AutoWeb on being, or were they, like, so you left you with another designer, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. All right, so let's go through that story. That was a terrible question that I just asked.
There's a question there?
It wasn't even a question.
No, I remember Sherry and I were talking about, you know, she had the domain name eStudio, and she's like, I really think, she had been there for a while too, and she's like, I really think we should leave, and I think we can make our own agency. Like, everybody needs a site, and it looks like a good business to be in. And so I was still having fun at AutoWeb, because again, it was kind of my first main corporate job, and I was getting to do a lot of design and so forth. But
and your girlfriend went there.
Yeah, and then Ruth at the time was there, so that was good. So I decided one night that, you know, I'd felt that I had earned my way into more of a director position at AutoWeb, and so that was going to be the litmus test. I was going to walk in, talk to Frank and Payam, tell them that, you know, all the things that I've been doing and that I deserve to be, you know, at a director level. And it was like a 5-minute conversation. They're like, well, we don't think you're ready. You know, you've only been here, I think it was like 8 or 9 months, maybe.
That's about right. That's about enough.
Yeah, it's very much like, So anyway, I kind of saw that as a sign. So Sherry and I started working kind of, you know, it wasn't like we left our jobs, you know, and then started it. We started taking side and building up the agency. And then once it got to a certain critical mass is kind of when, you know, I put my notice in. Then we were working out of Sherry's living room.
I forgot about that. I think I went over there. Yeah. Then you had the office next to Jack in the Box.
That was awesome, because the French toast sticks every morning was my...
I was like, how do you do that?
Yeah. All I remember is I would go over there and at lunch go to Jack in the Box. And I think that was when Jack in the Box introduced their extra thick milkshakes. So everyone would get a milkshake and you're basically sucking for the life of you to get the milkshake. You know, it's not like a...
That Oreo shake?
You know, yeah. And so you're inhaling so much air that then there was this awkward hour at the office where everyone's like, man, everyone has basically gas. Everyone's like, what is this from? And it's like, wait a minute. Swallowing, I think everyone's air. Just inhaling air for an hour.
Yeah. Like cookies and cream. But I think around that time, you and I were still, even though I was still, you know, we were working on eStudio kind of full time. I think you and I were still working on startup ideas simultaneously, because a lot of the,
yeah,
like this, Four Insight,
the sports one.
Four Insight stuff. Yeah.
So we had this idea. So I, before AutoWeb, I had worked at the Padres, and they were the first team to implement a fan reward program. So you'd go to the game, you'd scan your card at a kiosk, and you'd accumulate points. The more games you went to, you get like a free soda or discount in the merch store or whatever. So we came up with this idea. It's pretty similar to Ken's approach to HTML, where we we, like, Ken mocked up these screens We're going to call it For Insight. And I think I remember we mocked up a Warriors one with like Muggsy Bogues on it.
Yeah, there's a Dodger
one. We got meetings with the Warriors, the Sharks, the Dodgers, the Trailblazers, and I don't think the Giants. But we, I remember we flew to Portland. Yeah. We flew to, we went to Dodger Stadium. We went to the Warriors, went to the Sharks. And what we would go in this pitch, and we'd be like, yeah, we're going to create this kiosk-based system so you don't have to staff it. And we're going to put kiosks around the stadium, and fans are going to come in. And I think we even said we're going to do away with cards. They're just going to log in somehow.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, wow. But Ken's slides looked so awesome that there was – I think they gave us the benefit of the doubt. And then we'd sit there and we'd be like, what are we going to do if someone says okay? Like, or people would be like, how much is it? We just made up – I think we said like $150,000 sounds like a lot of money. $150,000. But and then – I think with a couple of them, were like the Warriors were like, but we're willing to just take a luxury suite instead of payment.
Yep. I remember that.
Partially because they were like, that'll be way, dude, we'd do that job in exchange for its luxury suite and be able to go to all the games. I don't remember the Dodgers one as much. I can remember the Portland one because that one, you know, I actually had to fly up there, sleep at a hotel, go into this pitch. And then we would have gotten clients. I think it was I can't remember which two sports, but I believe it was hockey and baseball.
I thought it was basketball, no?
Or it was two sports, both went on strike.
Right, that was the...
Two sports went on strike, and I don't remember the timing of it, but your sales cycle was basically the off season. Like, you can't pitch this to them, or they're not going to agree to it during the season. So the combination of strikes and, like, the timing of the season gave us where we had, like, no realistic... sale that was going to happen in the next like 3 months. Who knows? At that point, it might have been. There's no one's going to fucking buy this in the next 7 days. We're out of here. But so we abandoned that plan. But we
Have the product? Could you actually have built the thing?
Well,
we
we looked online, and I remember we found like kiosks. And we're like, oh, okay. There's a kiosk case.
Yeah, we knew where all the parts were.
And then we were like, I think they probably have good Wi-Fi in the arena. And
sure,
we'll just put a monitor and. Yeah. We'll find someone to build a database, and so we figured if we got the money or the suite, we would be able to
hopefully the money not
fill
the
in the plan. But then we got a little article written about us in the Sports Business Journal or something, mm-hmm. because we basically scrapped the plan, and I think we'd actually completely forgotten about the plan. And then the next year, whenever the next offseason rolled around, I remember we got an inquiry from it was either the Indiana Pacers or the Cleveland Cavaliers of like, hey. We're interested in doing a fan loyalty program, and we're like, totally forgot about that idea. Fuck. So,
I forget what we were working on at that point. Was it the college student one? That one came after.
No, Four Students was before. That was right when that, because that was what pushed me over the edge of leaving AutoWeb.
Oh, that's right.
So Ken created that. That was the one. Ken just created a page. That looked like Yahoo, but it said forstudents.com, and it was like a student directory where you'd have to have a student email and all that stuff. And then we also did, I don't remember what else we did. Basically, we just, you know, I'd be like, this guy's a genius. We can come up with ideas, and then he can just crank something out, which looks so legitimate. And back then, a lot of it was, you didn't have all the tools as readily available, so if you had like a really good screenshot, basically, of a homepage, and then if his design was just better than everyone else's, it like, it felt like a legitimate product.
Yeah, that's so all you needed.
Yeah. So he had eStudio with Sherry, and then I went over there, and I was let's just brainstorm ideas, because, I mean, that was what, I think Ken's always kind of towed the line of, like, all these clients, being, like, high in demand by all these clients to do work for them, and then also wanting to work on ideas at the same time. So I went over there. I still remember Sherry one day coming in and being like, all right, if you're going to sit here and take up all Ken's time thinking of ideas, then you need to go sell some web design stuff. I was like, go to door-to-door selling web design? I'm out of here.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, how much did you sell, Nick? I don't remember any.
I remember being like, huh, okay, well, let's just, and I think we just said, like, all right, let's just brainstorm on the side. So what happened with eStudio? So you guys were off to a great start.
Yeah. I mean, basically, Sherry came in one day and she, you know, this was 98 maybe at that point. And she's like, I think we can raise think we can raise some funding, you know, so we can kind of grow. I think, you know, a lot of the other agencies, the IXLs, and like there are a lot of agencies that were growing and actually going public. And so it's like, well, why not follow that exit strategy?
Hold on, real quick. So up to that point, so you got jobs while you got basically clients while you were still working at AutoWeb.
Right.
So you had steady money coming in. Was it recurring? Like you'd get a client and they would pay you every month, or was it just enough backlog of one-off clients?
I think there are more one-offs. I think we had some maintenance stuff, but because it was kind of more of a build versus like we weren't doing like actual marketing for them. We were just doing more or less kind of, you know, .com development. Once you were done, it was kind of some maintenance, but you were more or less on to the next.
But you were able, by keeping your jobs while you got clients, you were able to basically transition without having to invest any of your own money.
Yeah, I mean, the service business is pretty self-sustaining, you know what I mean? You know, as opposed to going out, building a product, getting it to some degree, and then figuring out how to take it to market. Service, it's like, you know, you can scale it pretty easily. So starting out, you know, kind of both having a day job and a night job. I mean, I remember many a nights sleeping on Sherry's couch with Ruth sitting in there reading a book, and then I'd wake back up and start working on it, and then we'd work till the morning, and then I'd wake up and then go back into AutoWeb. So, yeah, you basically have to, you know, forget sleep for a while if you're going to do that transition. But yeah, eventually it was unsustainable. So it was like, okay, cool. We've got enough work. There's enough sort of line of sight on future work. Let's leave. And I felt good because Ruth was still at AutoWeb. So at least, you know, there was another income coming in.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then you, so then what happens? So you guys were doing well. And then eventually eStudio took a turn for the worse. What was that kind of story or lesson there?
So, yeah, so it was when, you know, we raised about $5 million from a VC in Hong Kong through Sherry's contact. We were all 20, 21, and it was all for us to scale. But at that time, you know, nobody wanted to put in anything less, and our business plan, you know, really didn't need that. So we almost had to come up with another business to be able to constitute the raise. Like, we needed a business plan that actually needed $5 million because, you know, the agency business didn't do that.
I forgot about that, you had the design thing. Yeah.
That was pretty funny because we were sitting there basically trying to brainstorm, okay, what else could we do that would justify, you know, three more million? Because we only thought we needed two. So Sherry was really interested in building an e-commerce business. And so we said, great, okay, so we're going to raise this $5 million. You know, me and the other guys are going to work on kind of the agency side, and Sherry's going to go and do the e-commerce side, which, you know, now it's obviously a recipe for failure. It's like, oh, we're going to just basically take this money and have two separate businesses that probably are not going to know what the other one's doing, which is more or less kind of what happened. You know, the funding came in, typical, like, we're buying all Herman Miller cubicles. I think we spent, I don't know how much, $50,000 on cubicles and rented a big space and built out the warehouse and started hiring. We spent all of our time hiring people.
Was that the big space that had like the music studio kind of thing in it? I remember that. You guys also had, for Sherry, you also had some fancy leather jackets from what I remember one day.
Yeah, I mean, we got really good. We got really good at like buying stuff and hiring people. And, you know, at the time, I mean, you know, it's like most of the time goes into negotiating what people want in order to come over. I mean, every single person we were trying to bring over from like different larger companies, it was like, I want this kind of chair. I only want to work on this day. I want, you know, it was just it took up all the time. And so we did have a lot of big successes in the sense of we started producing content for shockwave.com. You know, a lot of our content was right up there with Matt and Trey on the South Park side and Stan Lee and also Tim Burton Stainboy. So we were creating a lot of awesome content through the agency and the studio. But at that time, nobody knew how to make any money at it. So there was no... there's no revenue coming in, and the e-commerce side was just getting off the ground. So, long story short, is we burned through the $5 million.
What was the e-commerce company?
What was it called? Design Freak.
And what was it going to sell?
It was trying to be kind of like an Egghead software meets kind of like a Getty, to where it was like made for design, the designers and the web developers, where it had deals on, you know, Adobe products and Macromedia products, but then also sold like fonts and stock images. So
how did you find out that you've burned through the money? Because from what I remember, you weren't aware of the fact that you were getting close to burning through.
Yeah, I mean, the VCs that had put the money in, you know, they were from overseas, and they didn't put any management in addition to us. And this was the first time we were all doing this. And so, you know, we had central accounting and financing, and there was a sense of where we were. But at that point in time, you know, like 98, 99, from what I recall, it was all about you need to scale as fast as you can so that you're ready for your next round. You know, the profitability, revenue was not necessarily, you know, the mark. It was, can you scale? Can you hire the right team? And can you start to build essentially the foundation? But right as we got to that point was right when the whole bottom started to fall out on the whole .com boom or bust, rather. And so it was just poor timing. You know, we were already sort of set up to kind of have our next round. But at that point, the investors were like, we're not prepared to do that. And we had like, I think we had like 60 or 70 people at that time. And most of them hired over a 7-month period. And it basically, we had to lay them off. So I think it was like 23, having to step in front of a room of like 50, 60 people. Jesus. And have to tell them that, you know, that we had to lay them off. And so that was a character builder, you know, for that one. But what we had negotiated with the investors was, you know, we started to get representation from some of the, from UTA in LA, because this is when the talent agencies in LA really wanted to start representing digital talent. So I pitched the investors. I'm like, look, we actually think LA is going to be a pretty interesting space for people of our expertise. They've got the storytelling, but they don't have the technology. You know, we can go down there and kind of, you know, have representation. So they gave us a bridge loan. I think it was like $500,000, and it was to essentially take a small crew and relocate down to Venice and essentially start building back up again, but kind of more in the entertainment technology space.
Did the first company close and like a new entity was formed, or did it just transition?
So when we were in Venice, we started growing again. We started working with Warner Brothers. We were working with Nancy Cartwright on some stuff. And right about 9/11, when 9/11 happened, it essentially all work stopped. And we had a decent amount of bills still from our Silicon Valley days of, like, we had these Dell server leases that were like 7-year leases that were twice our monthly costs in Venice. So a lot of it we were paying for, you know, kind of the decisions that had been made. And perfect storm of that, the work drying up, and sort of uncertainty. And it essentially was, the investors basically then pitched us on us becoming a training center so they were based in Hong Kong. They wanted to essentially turn us into a training center so where they could bring people over from Hong Kong. We would train them on to do what we do, and then they would go back. And that sounded not like the job I wanted to be doing.
How would you describe what you got? What was your core competency at this point? Is it 3D stuff? Is it like, what is it?
Our expertise really was, you know, at the time, Flash was, you know, kind of the technology of choice to do really expressive, kind of immersive content. And, you know, because of our 3D background, because of our understanding of animation, because of one of my other business partners' background in video production and music, I mean, we were essentially bringing a whole production studio, but to a web environment. And so that was kind of our calling card. We could, And it worked really well up in the Bay Area when we were working with like semiconductor companies and Cisco and stuff. I mean, like we were, the bar was pretty low. So we could come in and really kind of over deliver. We went down to LA. It was definitely a lot more fitting because like the gaming companies and the entertainment companies, you know, this is when like the million-dollar Harry Potter websites were being done. And so it was a natural fit. You know, we essentially got a call from GE. So that was our big break after we left. So actually, I missed that point. We ended up deciding to leave eStudio, not knowing what we were going to do. The investors still kept it going, and they eventually shut it down.
In Venice, right? So this is in Venice. Yeah. So eStudio still exists, and you and a couple guys said, we're going to leave because this entity is all fucked up.
Yeah, well, they're just the pivoting. Like, yeah. We weren't interested in the pivot as far as being kind of more in the training space.
Yeah.
You know, we were still interested in the craft of what we were doing. You know, even though the work had dried up, you know, during sort of 2001. So we weren't sure what we were going to do. We, you know, we'd been through so much, you know, kind of growing and having to lay a bunch of people off and then moving to a whole new part of the state. We weren't necessarily ready to jump back into agency work again.
Sorry, one more question. So when you leave as one of the founders of the agency, like what happens? Like do you still have equity in that agency? Do you still have any obligations to it? Like you just walked, or are you just saying, hey, this thing I thought one day would be worth something, and I'm just going to walk away from it, and I don't get anything from it in the future? Or were you still hoping like, I'll leave, do something I want, they'll hire some replacements, and maybe that equity will still be worth something one day?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think that way back then. You know, I mean, I think differently now, you know, in those kind of like, well, you know, it's, you never know which seed you plant is going to grow, you know? So back then I was just like, if I don't have to worry about it, I don't want to have to worry about it. So even if there is something there, and even if it grows, I was very myopic. You know, and so I think in when we left, it was like, you know, kind of a total release, you know, of liability, in the sense of like, you guys don't owe me anything. As long as I don't owe you anything, you can do whatever you want with it. You can have the name, you can do whatever. This is not for me. I need to find my next thing.
Yeah. All right. Sorry to keep interrupting you.
That's good.
No. That, you know, it's a good point. I don't even remember that conversation fully. All I remember is like, I just need to like shake the Etch-A-Sketch, you know, and clear everything off of it and basically start working again.
Yeah, because sometimes it's like you've put something into something, you want it to be worth something. Even when you walk away, it's not an easy decision of like, should I, you know, psychologically, if I just walk away, I owe you nothing, you owe me nothing. That's probably the best path for moving forward. But a lot of times you get sucked into like the what ifs, and it's kind of like, I still want a little bit of something, and I'll do a little bit of something, and then it's just like this, you know, it's this thing in the back of your head that you just can't shake and get a fresh start.
Yeah, it's actually, whether for better or for worse, I actually like the more kind of clear-cut situations. It's when it's in the middle, and it's the same sort of over-analysis where you're like, but what if this is the thing? What if I'm giving up too early on it? And, you know, and so that's ultimately what kind of ended up being sort of the driver with Blitz, you know, because Blitz was a 15-year run, you know, because essentially after we left eStudio, I had bought a house in Valencia, which, if you know, Venice to Valencia is not the shortest drive. And at the time, my wife, you know, now, you know, was there doing operations. Our first son, Ethan, you know, he was raised in the office. All of his baby pictures are in cubicles, and all of his like, seriously, all of his bounce, like these bouncy things that you put in the doorway, there were like always an office doorway pathway. So we would come home from Venice, three of us, at like 1 a.m, and then go home, sleep in Valencia, all be back in the car, drive back to Venice. And so after we left, it was so great to not have to do that anymore. I was like, I just want to work out of my house. And so we made the decision. We got a pretty large house at the time, and my two other business partners that left at the time, I was like, hey, why don't you guys move in with us? So it was kind of weird, you know. I knew them really well, but essentially at that point now, I was living in a house with my wife and our first son and my two other business partners. And then we decided to convert the garage into the music studio again, you know, because we were like, well, what if we start working on stuff again? So my office basically became, or my house became the office again. And we thought, this is great. You know, the office was in Valencia and it was near CalArts. And we're like, okay, if we need to hire anybody, nobody's out here. We're just going to have all of this fresh talent coming out of CalArts. Problem was, is once we started getting clients, nobody knew where Valencia was. So we never got anybody to come to us, even though we prepared for it. And so we ended up having to drive back into LA, back into Burbank. And so it was the same deal again. But that's basically when we decided to make Blitz and create kind of an office.
And with Blitz, did you self-fund or did you get investors?
Or is it self-fund.
Nice.
We had enough when we had representation from UTA. That first year, they essentially introduced us to everybody in town, all the studios.
And UTA and, is like a UTA is a United Talent Agency.
Yeah, yeah.
So and they like, usually you know, represent actors and actresses and those kind of things, or
right, yeah. Right. So we actually had originally been contacted by CAA when we were up in the Bay Area, and when we took that meeting down in LA, this was kind of the reason, the justification for you know moving down to LA is CAA was like, look, we want to start representing digital talent. You know, we've got partnerships with Coke. We could walk you into all of these deals, and so there was very much kind of like a kind of a courting. But when we got down there, somebody told us, they're like, well, if you're going to meet with CAA, you might as well meet with William Morris. You might as well meet with Endeavor and everyone else. So we're like, cool. So we did this kind of talent agency tour. And then somebody said, you know, if you're going to have an agent, you really should have a manager. So then we started meeting managers. We didn't realize how much you give away when you have an agent and a manager.
Do they represent the company or each of you individually?
It was the company.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was us, but it was the company. It's kind of like we were the ones that they were pitching. But it was the company's work that kind of, you know, legitimized it. But anyway, through that process and then ultimately picking UTA, they introduced us to a ton of people. So when we decided to start over again, we already knew a bunch of people like at Warner Brothers and Sony and a lot of the other entertainment companies. So that was how we self-funded. We just started getting projects and were working out of my house at the time.
Nice. And then what was the... Like, what are the big... So, if Blitz was a 15-year run, what would you say are, like, the... I guess if you just... We go through, like, I don't know, four or five big transitions or times or...
Yeah.
The peaks and valleys. I don't think there wasn't any huge valleys, right? It was mostly...
No, there were valleys. Peaks.
All right. let's hear about valleys. Those. I like... fuck the peaks. I want to hear about the valleys. No, I want to hear about both. I mean, I think it's an interesting... Interesting.
Yeah. Story. I mean, you know, I would say, our first valley, if we had nine lives, that first live, you know, even though it was a different company with eStudio, that was the first, like, you know, from a euphoric rise to the basically reality of the other side of that equation.
How long was that again? That was over 3 years, 4 years?
eStudio, yeah.
Yeah.
It was 3.5, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there.
And then one before, I guess I keep asking questions and going backwards. So, at eStudio and then again at Blitz, how do you decide how much to charge people? Like in a service business?
You know, it is something that is still, I mean, even as I was leaving Blitz, everybody still talks about it. It's a problem, you know, because essentially, we brought in this consultant that helped us try to understand, and I forget what his name was, but he's a big advocate of that the problem with the agency business is that they look at cost instead of price. Like everybody's like, how much is this going to cost? And it's very sort of industrial age calculation of what is the effort of a person's time and what does that hour equate to in as far as, you know, a bill rate? But the example that always is kind of the sort of, you know, the North Star, where we should be kind of thing, is they use like a Frank Gehry as an example, where they're like, okay, well, if he sits down and he does a drawing of this building, and let's say it takes him only 2 hours to do, is it, it, are you basically paying him for those 2 hours? It's not. It's all the time that led up to his ability to be able to sit down and do it in 2 hours. And so, you know, the whole kind of, you know, value-based pricing versus sort of cost-based pricing, it's still a problem. Even more so now where you have large corporations, like once you get big enough to where you are dealing with large procurement agencies, they actually come in and they tell you how much margin you should have. They're like, this contract allows you to have a 10% or 15% margin. These are the bill rates that you need to be able to have for these positions. So it's a race to the bottom when it comes to those, you know, particular situations. So, you know, when we're small, you know, low overhead, you know, things like, wow, if they give us some free product, like, if, you know, if it's like a video game company is like
a Warrior
all
Suite,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a recurring theme.
It's like the luxury
dunk contest
like,
swag. Is what I work for.
No, seriously, actually, yeah. I'm still like that. It's like, oh, cool. Like, I'd work with them if I didn't have to buy, you know, those shoes anymore. I'd just get the shoes every day. So, but yeah, there's a lot of bartering. You know, you go through this mental exercise of like, oh, okay, well, we're not really going to get paid what we should, but it's going to be a great portfolio material. That was the common thing. Like, oh, this is going to be great portfolio material, and we're going to get so much more work because of it. But eventually, and I'll get to this later, eventually we hit the reality to where unless we started figuring out how to make money and be profitable, there was no exit strategy for us. Because the only way, you know, an agency these days, you know, exits is an acquisition. You know, no agencies go public like they used to, you know, in the late 90s. So our whole kind of financial and cost control and how we calculate how much stuff costs changed radically in like 2008, 2009. But up until that point, it was like, hey, you know, I think we all want to get new cars next month. What do we need to charge to reverse back from us being able to get new cars and stuff? So it's very scientific.
Well, I guess, yeah, before I keep it, what were, if you had to condense it
big
to
beats.
Four or five, yeah, like what were the...
So our first big break, you know, the entertainment work unfortunately dried up the moment we got into it, like the whole $1 million websites, like went away like 2 months after we decided that's what we were going to do. And plus, at least for us, the entertainment industry was difficult because there wasn't a lot of loyalty. Like you could go in, you could basically completely blow their socks off. So we won the bid to do Tim Burton's Corpse Bride website. And this was our big, massive project with the studios. We spent probably twice as much as we were going to get paid doing this Corpse Bride website. Damn. And it was great. You know, at the time, the big award in LA for entertainment sites was the Clio, the Key Art Award. So that was like the, you know, the bucket list. Like we have to win a Key Art Award. And so we put all of our effort into this Corpse Bride website. It won all these awards, won the London International Site of the Year, won the Key Art. And I remember we were like, well, this is great. We're in with Warner Brothers now. We're going to be able to do, you know, all the big sites now. And I remember getting the RFP for the next one. And it said they were going to be triple bidding it out. And I was like, well, why would you triple bid it out? We did all of this work and it was, you know, and we even paid for more than what we got paid. And at that moment, I was completely like, we're not doing any more entertainment sites anymore. Like, we need to find something else. And essentially that's when the gaming industry is like, okay, gaming industry, perfect. They need, you know, they need great storytelling and brand and sort of, you know, high fidelity design, but they're also already technical. You know, you could have technical conversations because they were building software. So the big beat there was deciding to work with gaming companies as our sole focus. And then what happened immediately after that, although, is we got a call from GE. So here we are working on all of these like gaming, you know, sites for Ubisoft and Electronic Arts and LucasArts. And we get this email, and it's from it was Tim McCleary at GE. And he said, "Hey, I really like what you guys are doing. We really need some help, you know, with this big relaunch of General Electric." And so we were like, what are we going to be doing? Like refrigerator websites or toaster websites? Like, we didn't understand what it was. And so he called us up and he said, "Look, GE is about to make one of the biggest shifts from, you know, their whole we bring good things to life to this imagination at work. Like, we're in so many different businesses, from energy and real estate and all these different sectors. But on the consumer side, nobody knows GE. You know, all they know GE is for refrigerators and toasters. So we're going to this imagination at work, and we have BBDO in New York working on the TV commercials and all the kind of traditional medium. But we really feel like we need to come out with like a big digital presence, something that nobody's ever seen before. But here's the deal. We know you guys are small. We know that this is a kind of a big undertaking, and you will only have about 60 to 90 days to do this whole thing. It has to launch in December. So if you're willing to take the risk, if you think you can pull it off, I think it was like $250,000 or $300,000. It was like three times more than what we were getting on any game website. And so we were so confident about it that they had one of their, she could have been the CMO at the time, I'm forgetting the name. We're in this small office in North Hollywood, and the room that is our conference room is essentially kind of a coat closet, where if you can imagine, the couch is up against one wall, and we had a projector projecting on the wall in front of you, where it was literally only like 3 feet away. Like, you could put your feet up onto the wall that you were viewing the screen. And so he said, our head of marketing is in the LA area, and she's going to drop by and make sure you guys are legit, because nobody had ever visited us. So this black town car pulls up. She has a driver. We're in North Hollywood in this office that is part of a kids talent agency, which is also awesome.
This is pre-Uber. This is pre-Uber, so a town car means something.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, oh, wow, this is fancy. So, you know, she's brought up to the second floor, past all of the kids learning how to act. And sat in the room. We showed her all the stuff that we were doing. And she left and said, "Great, you guys got the job." So we basically tried to kill ourselves to get this done, launched it. It was a huge success. We won a bunch of awards. And then basically GE became our client for the next 4 or 5 years.
Wow. That's is that a retainer thing where they just pay you, or it's just as they have projects, they send them to you?
They just had more projects than we could handle. Yeah. Well, so what was cool after we launched the Imagination at Work stuff is we started working on another project with GE, and Microsoft sent us an email. And my business partner, Ivan, he's the one that always watched our inbox, and he's like, "Holy crap, we just got an email from Microsoft. They want us to bid on this huge, you know, realizing potential campaign that they're about to do for Microsoft." And they sent in this request form, and it was like, "How many offices do you have globally? What's your annual earnings?" You know, just like, it was a crazy questions. And I remember telling Ivan, we shouldn't fill that out. Like, they're just going to waste time. There's no way they're going to consider us. We're going to look silly. But luckily, he was adamant about filling it out. And I went back, I remember leaving his office and just going back and like, I've got work to do. I don't have time to talk about forms and stuff. So he filled it out, and we got to the next stage. And then the next stage was further, inspection. And I said, sorry, the dog is...
Dog likes this part of the story.
Yeah, I think...
That's right. It adds character to the story.
It's probably Amazon. He filled out the form, got to the third round, got to the fourth round, and then finally I took it serious. And so essentially, I guess Bomber had seen the GE site that we had done and, you know, brought it up to his marketing team.
Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft.
Was he CEO at the time? I can't remember.
Whatever.
Steve Ballmer. Yeah. So essentially it was us up against like all of the big agencies. Like we were the sort of the small kind of scrappy underdog.
How many people did you have at this point?
Maybe 12. Yeah. 12 people. Yeah. And we put everything into it. It's like, okay, if we got this far, we need to kind of show up with like what we do. And one of the things that we do is like, we don't come in, like traditional agencies would come in and basically come in with case studies of what they've done, but we didn't have any case studies. Or you'd come in with a bunch of just kind of general thoughts because you didn't want to spend much money giving them the answer to the problem until they hired you. But we essentially wanted to go in and show them what it would look like. So, long story short is that, you know, we won that work. The Microsoft GE kind of big beat was kind of our big big break that grew the agency, that made us have to figure out how to do all these other jobs of like project management and account management and put all these things in place. The other big beat was once we started to grow, you know, we had to start hiring up and finding a more responsible financial sort of direction. We were spending all the money on just trying to make the best thing possible, but we weren't making any money. And so margins were always super thin and we were still independent. So payroll got to be a huge issue. Like missing one check at that point in time was like a big deal. Like we missed one, if GE's check was late, we were gonna have to come in and tell people that they're not getting a paycheck because we didn't really have any buffer. So it was nerve-wracking. I think the biggest kind of like aspects of that time was just it was payroll. That was my biggest fear at the time. And so once we figured out that we really needed to figure out how to make money, we brought in a CFO, Dean. He basically worked on how to make sure that the way we budgeted and the way we hired and our overhead and everything, that somebody was actually paying attention to it. About that time, I was interested in leaving. I wanted to sell. I felt like this is the only thing I'd ever done, you know, my entire career for the most part.
So right at the high point. You're like, we got GE, we got Microsoft. I want out of here.
Actually, you know, I wanted out at least two or three times, and it wasn't because it was terrible. It was just like I was tired. Things were good. I wanted to go out on a high. And people, you know, the buying and selling of agencies is very cyclical. Like you get these big agencies that buy up a bunch of agencies. A lot of it doesn't work out. People leave. They make boutique agencies. Then clients want to hire boutique agencies because they're all just best in class. But then they get tired of having a bunch of agencies. So then they want one agency. So then you get acquired. And it was just, you know, on those high points where people were out buying, that's when we wanted out. Or that's when I wanted out. So we, you know, a couple big beats was going to New York, meeting with the WPPs, meeting with the Omnicoms, looking to sell. But at the time, the thing with selling an agency is, you know, your EBITDA, you know, and the multiplier you get is all based on where you're at as far as revenue and size. So there's always this dilemma of, well, they're giving us this deal, but based on our trajectory, if we wait one more year, we're gonna hit this multiplier. So the greediness of wanting to just basically wait was our Achilles heel each time. Because sure enough, that year that we decided to not take the deal and wait, something happened. Some crash, some big client lost, and we more or less had to kind of start climbing again. And so finally, around, you know, so 2015, we finally were at a stable size. We're a little over 120, 130 people, profitable. We started doing this, our third kind of road trip, looking for someone to acquire us. And we didn't, our strategy was to basically find a strategic fit, as opposed to the WPPs and the Omnicoms and everything. And so, you know, we found Advantage through Leonard Green and Partners, sold the agency, had a 2-year earnout, and they have since consolidated other agencies and rebranded Blitz and AMP, and I think they're like 300 or 400 people now.
Wow. Yeah. So one story I remember talking to you once, and I never understood it, was how much you spend on a pitch. Like, I remember you telling me at one point, like, oh, we're doing this pitch. Like, how does that work? And what happens if you don't, like, how often do you spend a ton of money on a pitch and then not get it?
Yeah, that was a sore spot for me. And actually, towards the end, I really tried to look at it differently, because the way I wanted to look at it was, here is a brand or a business coming in and asking us, the way I perceived it, as asking us to invest in their company. Because these pitches would be $100,000, $200,000 we'd spend. Whoa. Like the Kia pitch lasted 4 months. And we had like 30 people working on the pitch. And we spent well over, you know, $200,000-$300,000 on that pitch. Because, you know, the an automotive account, that was like the thing. If you were in LA, you made it when you had an automotive account.
What's the price? Like, just the rough, like, you spend $300,000. What are you trying to get? Like, how big of an account would it be?
I think it would have been like $10 million. $10 million account. Yeah,
that's decent.
Yeah,
risk.
All right. Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Return.
So what happens? Like, what happens if you, like, during that process? What happens to the 30 people? Like, emotionally, and do they have jobs if you don't get the pitch? And what, like, how many? Like,
yeah.
Do a lot of agencies fall apart because they do something really good, then they start extending themselves on pitches, don't get any of it, and it's just, that's it?
Yeah. It's the whole, you know, vetting process and what you pitch and how you pitch and how much you spend. It's really kind of what makes or breaks, because a lot of the times, even in what you use to pitch, the problem I always had is when companies go out and they ask somebody to bid on something, it creates this really false kind of sense of what it's going to take to win. Because basically you have to go in there and sort of you have to come in and have the most prolific thinking, right? The most tangible, like, wow, these guys get it, and look how fast they are. Because even in the pitch, they've already created all this stuff and they've got all these great ideas. So you end up basically pitching a lot of stuff that, you know, if you've done it for a while, you know they're never going to buy. They're never going to afford. They're never going to basically be brave enough to do. But yet, you put it all into this pitch. And so you get hired, and they're like, oh, man, these guys were awesome. Look at all this stuff they did. And part of it's because we didn't have a client at that time. We got to do whatever we thought was right. So, you know, we were spending a lot of money, but we were going really quick, and we were doing what we thought. But the problem is that once you get hired, and now you have the client sort of in the mix, you now have all of the concerns of the, will this work? You know, do we really want to spend the money on this part of it? And it really starts to get watered down to what's safe. And where it bites you is when they look at it one day and they're like, man, this is not why we hired you guys. When you guys pitched, like, the creativity was crazy, and all of the, like, that thing with the spinning thing, like, but you come in and they've
make it kind spin. Of
steered you in a way where, you know, they're the client now. They, you know, they ultimately get to say, you get screwed right there, where you spend a bunch of money, you won the project, you don't get to actually end up doing the, you know, all the things that would have actually then made that project profitable. And now they're also complaining about how you're not as, you know, you're not as awesome as you were on the honeymoon, you know?
That's interesting, because it's a much bigger version of dunk contest. So dunk contest, the Warriors and the NBA were like, when the NBA gave us a license, they're like, yeah, you guys have like this edgier, vibe, which we don't currently have anyone in that space. The Warriors are like, yeah, we think you could add an edgier vibe to our selection. And then you go ahead and create stuff, and it's like you submit each design. It's like,
too edgy.
That's too edgy. That's too edgy. That's too edgy. That's too edgy. Can you make, yeah, here's the parameters you can work within. And then you do it all. And then they go, huh. I remember the, I remember Brandon, who was on here, the CRO, and I remember Rick Welts, the president of the Warriors, being like, kind of was expecting something a little edgier from you guys. It's like, well, what the fuck? Every time we submit something, the team or the league reject it because it's too edgy. So that's funny that it happens at that level. How was the, so once you, are you still there? You're frozen on the screen. Once you,
that's a good screenshot.
Once we did the, once you did the deal, so how long did it take to, from the time you started talking to the acquirer till you closed the deal? And then how was it, like, psychologically, you wanted to get out and now you've got a 2-year earnout. So basically you, I mean, we already know, based on your AutoWeb history, that 2 years is an eternity.
So like, and college. Yeah, college is 2 years. 2 years.
So how do you manage that process of like, A, deciding, okay, because it's like people think you sell something and you just get all this money up front and that's it. And obviously that happens sometimes, but in a lot of businesses, there's an earnout.
Yeah, especially service.
So you're almost gambling on yourself. What you're going to get, you're not guaranteed, you don't know for sure. So there's a chance that it could, you're kind of like agreeing to be sold. And someone says, how much did you get? And you go, I'm not sure yet. I got to wait a couple of years. How is that for you and for the team? Like, do they lose, you know, because they're sitting there going, oh, I thought I was going to be at this place forever. Now they fucking sold it. But they still want me to stay here for 2 years. How is that?
Well, I mean, what? So yeah, I mean, in the agency business, you know, our product is basically time with people. You know, I mean, when the people walk out the door, like that's, you know, that's kind of our thing. And so, Ivan and I, at the very beginning, you know, we'd seen, even though we hadn't gone through previous sort of opportunities to get acquired, we had a really good understanding of what, from a buyer's side, what they feared the most. And their big fear is they acquire this company, and then all of a sudden, the day after, all the talent walks out, you know, and so knowing that, we had essentially put in I think it was called a phantom stock plan. It was basically, how could we give everybody a piece of the pie, but basically treat it as a as an approach where, so what buyers don't want is they don't want a bunch of the equity split out across a bunch of different owners. And so at the time, there was only a couple of us, but we wanted to be able to kind of give everybody a piece of that. So knowing that we were going to have an earnout, the most sensible thing to do is like, okay, cool. Everybody's going to basically take the same trip we're going to take. When we get acquired, everybody's going to get something up front, because that's basically, you get half up front when you get acquired. And then the other half is all based on you hitting your numbers. And so a 2-year earnout is actually so any big deal, like if we would have gone with WPP, Omnicom, any of these large networks, they're all 5-year earnouts. And so when they offered us a 2-year earnout, it was like, this is great. Now the downside of it is you have a lot less time to hit your numbers. So it kind of could also, you know, be an issue, because you may just start, you know, the first year they kind of leave you alone, you know, after you're acquired. And then after that, they really start putting in more of their kind of like process and operations. And if that mucks with your ability to hit your numbers, then you know you could basically prematurely end your earnout. So,
is the earnout a cumulative? Like, is it like a cumulative profit over that period of time, or is it like we'll take the best 12 months out of those 2 years, or how does it?
I think it works differently with the 5-year earnout, because I think you get like you get some of it at the 2-year mark, and then you have a three-year mark. But it's kind of a bracketed system where you could either hit a revenue goal or you could hit a profitability goal, basically. And so you know, sometimes if the profitability is decent and you can just get a lot more work and scale and keep your profitability, then it's better just to go that route, just to try to get as big as you can. Sometimes if you're not very profitable and you could basically hit your numbers by just cost cutting and figuring out ways of getting things done cheaper. So people take different tacks. For us, it was a little bit of both. You know, we definitely had some ability to become more profitable, but we also needed to scale at the same time.
What percent of your earnout did you end up hitting?
We didn't hit all of it. I'm trying to remember. It was most of it. Oh. It was most of it. But it was down to the wire because there was essentially one big client. We had one big client at that time, at the tail end of 2015. It was Faraday Future, which if you've looked at kind of, you know anything about them, they've had kind of a meteoric rise, and then they had financial problems. And so our whole ability to hit our earnout was really lying on us not only being able to successfully get all the work done that we needed to get done, but also their ability to pay. Because if they all of a sudden had financial problems. So, I mean, I drove 3 hours a day for 6 months to basically work with the team on site at Faraday to help them get ready for CES, which is when they revealed the FF91.
It was an electric car, right?
Yeah. They just raised $2 billion, I think, 3 months ago.
So you got paid.
Yeah. So I mean the employees were tied into the earnout. So that's essentially like what kept everybody, you know, kind of all on the same path.
Nice. So I got two more questions. So one is, you started off, you and Sherry, and then obviously grew, you know, that agency, and then started again with a couple guys, and then grew that agency. Is there a way to just be like a 4 to 5 person agency? And like, there's my every podcast phone call. Is there a way to have like a, you know, like a 3, 4, 5 person agency that can sustain a level that like everyone gets to work on really creative stuff? You got enough money coming in and you don't need to keep pushing for like bigger and bigger things? Or is it always going to be like, you're going to get to 4 or 5, you're going to get a bigger client, you're going to staff up for that, and then you're just going to want to keep going? Like,
I think it depends on what kind of agency you are. Like, I've seen branding agencies, you know, keep it small and be, you know, you just got to be super picky, you know. And if you value what you bring to the table, and the hardest thing is saying no, because when you're independent, you never know whether there's going to be another project on the other side of it. So you find yourself taking work, not because you're getting what you should get, not because it's even really worth doing. It's just, you know, you think about, well, if I don't get this, we're going to be at a loss this month, and maybe we could do it again the next month. But unless we get something that we like, you know, we're going to run out of money. So if you were very savvy in that respect and had good discipline, and you could basically build up your brand name, you know, of the, like, you know, where the agency is chasing you just as much as you're chasing, or sorry, the clients are chasing you just as much as you're chasing them. And there's kind of a mutual respect, and there's an exclusivity. It's like, okay, cool. I got these 5 people to work on my brand, and everybody wants them. Pull it that way, that's great. You can do that with things like branding and maybe some particular types of design or even architecture. But if you're trying, there's no way you can build, you know, your classic sort of full service agency where you're handling their media and their, you know, advertising and all this stuff. And a lot of people felt that that's what you had to do to be able to get to a size so that you could get bought. Because there are some people that are okay doing and being small, and they don't have any desire to ever sell. You know, they just love what they do and they just want to keep doing it, and it's always new for them. But if you're in the business, if you're working on the business as well, you know, instead of just in the business, you have to figure out, you know, what value are we building and who's going to buy it. And that's when you get kind of trapped in needing to grow. Because they always say, like, nothing ever stays the same. Stuff either grows or dies. So that was kind of the way it went.
Yeah. And then last question, which I thought was interesting. Like, you're like, got this agency, you're cranking, you're working on like super high profile, I'm assuming cutting edge, at least during the pitch. side of things, but I remember you telling me, like, I just feel like I'm in Groundhog Day because I'm just spending a bunch of time coming up with ideas for someone else.
Yeah.
You have your own company, but you don't have, you know, it feels like you're just doing stuff for other people, and then versus building your own thing. Have you come full circle back to Design Freak now? What's going on here?
No, you know, it does. I mean, I can recall, I mean, even early days, even 99, I remember being out, our office was in Fremont, and I remember standing outside and basically feeling like we're doing such a good job at opening the door for everyone else, but yet we don't get to walk through it. And that was kind of a sort of a systemic kind of theme. The addictive part of the whole agency experience is you get an inside seat to so many people's problems, right? So I've sat in so many meetings of like large brands struggling with problems that you would have no idea from the outside. But the funny thing is when you are that person going from meeting to meeting at all these different companies, they all have similar problems. And so through that whole experience, there were two aspects. One is these really awesome ideas that we were coming up with that they were never going to actually do, but I knew that they could actually be real businesses. It was a pain to see these great ideas never actually get executed, you know. And so we tried at one point to have a product side of our business and a service side, but they're two different companies, and yeah. And I didn't want to do the East Design Freak, you know, East Studio thing again. So we never really did that. So I knew that after the agency business, I wanted to finally be able to kind of drive some disruptive, innovative thinking all the way through. If it was on me now to make it happen, that was important. And yeah, just being able to leverage the fact that I've learned so much by sitting in all these different companies and seeing similar problems, and I guess in my head it was like, okay, what are you going to do with this knowledge now? Like, how's this going to pay off in this sort of next chapter? And the easy thing would be is to go and do another agency because it's fun and there's always something new and it's different. But I guess for me, it's kind of returning back to our our four insight days of, you know, being able to take the ability to pitch, take the ability to rapidly prototype stuff, knowing kind of the operational kind of gravity that comes with this and employees and stuff, but be able to actually turn it into a product that we could, you know, push out.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. And we're working on something that hopefully one day we can talk about. But Ken's always, I mean, what's cool is, I didn't really think about it till this process, is 20 years ago, you were this bleach blonde hair creative guy, right? And I always thought, dude, this is the most creative guy I've ever met. And like, he can take things in your head and just crank them out that are way better than you ever had in your head. And what I've realized now working on this new project is you learned a shitload of business stuff over the years. Like, you're like, you know, it's still creative, but like,
you learn HTML in 48 hours, and of course,
dude. Like when we're sitting there talking, like he like knows things down to this like granular level of like. I mean, it's almost like fucking. It gives me like information overload. Like he'll use all these like mind map things, and it's like there's 4,000 little details.
I just want to know what it's like as a longtime friend of Nick's, Ken. When Nick pitches you like some crazy idea, and you think, "Whoa, this is not going to work." How do you let him down easy? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. I don't think
steers it.
I think every time we talked about ideas, you know, even if it came in, at one point when you were working on, I forget which one it was, but you had this idea of like, well, what if based on color palettes, what if you took a picture of something and based on that color palette, we recommended clothing for you, some of those lines. It was kind of just, you know, we throw out ideas all the time, and I think it's fun working with Nick to kind of like find our way to an actual, like, you know, like, is this something that people would use? Like if most of the time most startups go out of business because, you know, our 80% make something that nobody wants, like that whole process of something just happened to me you know, while I was at the grocery store, or I was frustrated here, or you know, I saw something, and it doesn't seem like anybody's doing anything about it. So we'll go through our phases. It'll be like, well, what if it worked like this? And then we'll have all these ideas, and then we'll go online, and then we'll search around, and then we'll realize, you know, somebody, there's like 10 other companies doing it. We're like, shit, okay, never mind. We're not going to do that. So it's just that process of, I think, free brainstorming it, but then, you know, reality check, going out there and seeing if, A, if people want it, and B, if somebody's already doing it, you know, to the degree that we don't want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, our challenge, the fun part is we've literally been, you know, in different frequencies, right? There's times where maybe it's nothing for a couple of years, but for 20 years, basically, we've been sitting there brainstorming ideas. And then the challenge is we're both optimistic. So we're going to look at everything as like, that's doable. So it's almost like when you talk to Ken about an idea, you get more excited because there's another person going, yeah, we could do that. But then you think like, what if we're both fucking crazy and like neither of us are looking at the downside? But no, I think it's an awesome story. I mean, we could have talked for a few hours. You got so many, even just at the pitch level or random project level, I think there'd be so many interesting stories in and of that. And I think, you know, it's a,
let's bring them back.
Great story. Yeah. You're gonna have to come back.
Yeah. I've got some crazy, pitch stories. I've got projectors that have caught on fire at Mitsubishi.
We're talking about the wrong thing.
Right. Yeah, we'll do it. We'll start a new like pitch of the month with Ken. We can just talk about a random pitch.
When pitches go wrong.
Yeah.
when pitches attack.
And then we'll have him back and Dennis can just pitch Dennis's ideas.
Partywithdennis.com. There is a list. It is on fire.
Yeah, Dennis is kind of pissed. Dennis is like, I thought we were going to talk about my shit this
year. Yeah, what the fuck are we doing?
Who is Ken? And why are we talking to him the whole time? Yeah. Anyways, cool. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All right, cool. Talk to you later.
Later. Bye.
If you like what you hear, follow us on Instagram at the Startup Addict, Twitter, startup_addict, or even go to the website at thestartupaddict.com. And if you want to follow us on YouTube, please search for us for The Startup Addict, and we will be there. Thanks for listening.